daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. Coming up, China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi vows that China will always be a force for stability and peace. And we will hear from a leader of a listed cybersecurity company about his opinions regarding AI development. Nikki Haley ends her presidential bid but does not endorse Donald Trump. And Egypt secures an $8 billion US dollar International Monetary Fund deal after removing currency controls. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi says China is determined to be a force for peace and stability in the world amid many uncertainties. Wang Yi made the remark as he met with the press on Thursday to address questions on China's foreign policy and external relations at the annual gathering of China's National People's Congress. The senior diplomat has warned against the spreading negative views about China, suggesting that China will always stand on the right side of the history. He also said China's development is driven not only by reasonable growth in quantity, but also upgraded quality, stressing the role of economic diplomacy for China's opening up. So joining us now on the line is Dr. Wang Huiyao, president of the Center for China and Globalization. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And also we have Nassim Khan Achkaizai, executive director of Grandview Institution, which is a think tank headquartered here in Beijing. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. So Achkaizai, to start with you, regarding why China is a force for peace and stability in the world today, Foreign Minister Wang Yi actually cited a few specific examples, including China brokering a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran last year, and China helping negotiate a peace agreement in northern Myanmar. That's a recent development. So do you think China deserves to gain a credit on the international stage for doing these things?
Well, of course, if you ask me if yes or no, I would definitely say yes. And the reason being, it's the reconciliation process which was being brokered by China between Saudi Arabia and Iran specifically just does not stay to Saudi Arabia and Iran, but it has a larger, a greater impact on the entire Middle Eastern region, as well as countries like Pakistan, which are part of the Greater Balkan Zone. Because, quoting example is, let's see, in the past, before there was a rift between Saudi Arabia and Iran, countries like Pakistan had to maintain a balance when it came to their foreign policy between Saudi Arabia and Iran because of different reasons. But now things have eased up. So I think it's a very tremendous effort on behalf of China and also coming up to the world stage where other countries are getting into conflicts or creating conflicts, and China, on the other hand, is resolving problems and resolving conflicts. So this is one great example of reconciliation which was brokered by China, especially with regards to Saudi Arabia and Iran. So I think it's a very tremendous effort which was done by China, which has and will have a very long-lasting impact on especially on the Middle Eastern region.
And of course, apart from, say, Myanmar and this rivalry between Saudi and Iran, there are many, many other hotspot issues across the world today. We will probably touch upon them one by one later in our discussion today. But before we do that, in terms of a more equitable world order, Dr. Wang, Mr. Wang Yi actually said China cannot allow a few big powers to monopolize international affairs, suggesting a situation where, quote, if you are not on the table, then you are going to be on the menu, unquote, is something that China can by no means allow for. Now, actually, this table versus menu comment was made recently by a high-ranking U.S. official at this very recent Munich security conference held in Germany. So what do you think Wang Yi's comment here tell us about China's worldview.
Yes, I think that, you're referring to U.S. Secretary of State Blinken's comment at the Munich Security Conference, which I was there attending the conference as well. I think that, that's probably too straightforward, but basically what China has saying, we should really abide by the international law. We should really, seek the mutual respect, and also we should, country big or small. I mean, they're all equal, and also we have to, follow the charter of UN and the so-called international rule. We should really talk about UN-based rules and the UN charter. So I think that is really what China wants. And then, we don't want to say some country, if they make a decision, that have to be international or have to be international rule, or G7 rule is the international rule. So I would think that Minister Wang Yi is really talking about, we're getting into a multipolar war now. So it should reflect, all those global different opinions into the new global system, including China, of course, EU, Global South, and many others. So we should not, the days of only one country winner takes all probably gone. We are now in the 21st century, and we should really seek a mutual respect and win-win. And of course, to work together to this challenging time and to solve the challenging and global crisis that we're facing now, particularly the current crisis and also the future crisis.
So exactly, talking about Global South, Dr. Wang, one thing China did last year was actually helping achieve a historic expansion of the BRICS. Wang Yi argued on Wednesday that, on Thursday rather, that the expansion is a manifestation that the Global South is no longer the silent majority. What is your understanding in this regard?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And, Global South has been, the rise of the rest is really a new phenomenon in the 21st century. So you can see, of course, not only China, but also countries like India, ASEAN, Brazil, and talk about BRICS country. So actually last year, the BRICS country has doubled, and China is a leading country in the BRICS, framework. And actually, as a matter of fact, the BRICS countries accounted about 40% of global GDP. And then their GDP is larger than probably the G7 combined. And of course, in terms of population, they are even much larger. So I think that when we mean multipolar war, I mean, this global south has certainly become a big polar of that. So that's why I think we are facing a new reality now, and we have to be the size of the system that in the 20th century is not really fit now for the size of the 21st century of the globe, but now, and we have to find a new way to accommodate that, and that's mean by we need to work out a new global governance system, but it's really that is really workable and serving the needs of the new development. So I think the Global South is really getting more important. Of course, Global South still have a lot of challenges. But I think, this 80% population represented by Global South in the world is really a new driving force of the 21st century. And what you can see in the in Asian, where has the almost half of the world population and 40% of global GDP here, right in Asia. ASEAN, the rise of ASEAN is a remarkable success story. Mm-hmm. Which now ASEAN is the largest trading partner of China, so you can see this Global South has been really significant and important players now in the world, and we have to really find a way to all work together with Global North. Yeah.
So actually, the Global South is arguably a group among which many Western powers nowadays are also seeking to have a greater influence or sphere of influence, let's put it this way, through, say, promises of investment and security funds. So, Nassim, with regard to China's case, what do you think is China's vision for the Global South?
Well, I think, as Dr. Wang mentioned as well, I mean, he summarized that very well in this regard, but I think, let's say, for example, the days of expansion and intervention have long gone. For example, if someone talks of rules-based world order and this and that, and they themselves do not follow those rules and they can break and mend it whenever they want it, then things cannot work this way. So I think when we talk of the rise of Global South, some countries and people, unfortunately, they close their eyes and they do not accept the reality. So Global South and its rise is a reality which has to be accepted by the whole world. And as Dr. Wang mentioned as well, indicating towards the economy of, let's say, BRICS or the Global South as a whole, and then the ASEAN region, for example. This is a reality. And with regards to China, for example, China has been pushing economic partnerships with all these countries and the entire, different regions in the world. So there's nothing, there's no bringing wars to some place. There is no conflict involved in this. It's all mutual or the greater concept of a future with a global or common future which is shared. So I think with regards to China has been taking these steps one by one slowly, which has been impacting the economies and the overall development of these regions, which is very warmly welcomed by these countries as well, because nobody is interested in these days in any new conflict, which we already see that the whole world is burning at the moment. So on the other hand, China is bringing development to countries which had never seen these things before. So it's a win-win situation for bilateral between China and other countries, and as well as regionally. So let's say Central Asia, for example, has been a big beneficiary of the Chinese Belt and Road initiative as well. So who would want that a conflict comes to the region of the country? So I think China has been, like I said earlier as well, has been playing a very tremendous role when it comes to, you know, bringing its policy of economic development, which is for all, not for China itself.
So in terms of the bilateral ties with Russia, Wang Yi said Beijing and Moscow would continue to deepen their mutually beneficial cooperation. So Nassim, do you think the China-Russia relationship, as Wang Yi suggests on Thursday, has shown a new paradigm of great power cooperation that is entirely different from the Cold War era?
I think he was right in saying that, because I've been following his press conference as well. So, let's say whatever is happening in the region, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and then the whole West jumping in. So I think China has all its rights, and so does Russia, to have its own independent foreign policy whenever it decides and whatever it decides on doing. So there cannot be a dictation coming in from anywhere that who and how should a country decide on its foreign policy when it comes to that. So the Cold War era, as we said, is over. Bloc concentration is over. Now it is time for cooperation between, great powers. Russia, no doubt, is a big military power. If it wasn't, then the situation which we see in Ukraine these days would not have been happening. So it's a very good step. For example, when both these leaders met later last year, and to actually show it to the world that the things and issues can only be solved when you come to a table. So I think it is a very positive message that Russia has its own policies, China has its own, but then nobody can dictate whatever each other has to do, vice versa.
Okay, your point's well taken. Now, with regard to the China-U.S. relations, Dr. Wang, Wang Yi actually has reiterated a position of mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and a win-win cooperation. In the meantime, he has also pointed out that although there has been some improvement in the ties since President Xi Jinping and President Biden met in November last year, Washington continues to have a wrong perception of China or misperception about China. This is continuing, and Washington's promises once made to the Chinese side are yet to be fully fulfilled. What is your observation?
Yeah. I think what Minister Wang Yi mentioned is quite true. Of course, I think things last November San Francisco summit, where two president has met, but we have seen a lot of stability already. Maybe stabilized somehow. We have restored the defense dialogue, climate, and fentanyl discussion, and AI, and security, many other areas. But of course, but then we still got once in a while, or every now and then, we have new companies being sanctioned. We have new measures taken against Chinese companies. And we have even students being blocked at the border checks and things like that. So things are still not really expected. I think Minister Wang actually cited the President Biden's four promises or five promises on China. If the U.S. doesn't want to contain China development, if the U.S. doesn't want to seek to change China, I mean, we should have that reflect in action. So I think that's where the problem is, because we were hearing all those commitments from the high level officials of the U.S. government, but in the real situation, we see a lot of signals that indicate otherwise. So that's really the problem now. But I think probably this is also due to the politics of U.S. because you got the Congress, you got the media, you got the very negative, those bipartisan posters. China become a scapegoat in many, many things that for the domestic problem of U.S. For example, the staggering gap between rich and poor, and also the middle class, their living standard has not gone up for the last several decades, probably. And 1% of Wall Street, almost equal to 40-50% of the mass population in the U.S. So there's a lot of money made overseas, but not making benefit to the domestic audience, which are affected by globalization. So I think China is easily to become a scapegoat, or China take away your lunch, or China, has done this wrong, that wrong. So that really is unhealthy. I think that probably explains sometimes the politician has to do something in order to show that they are politically correct. So I think it's going to take time to overcome that. But absolutely, I think, if we really learn the lessons, for example, last 6-7 years, we have done all those, U.S. has done all those things, and it's really made the two largest economy in the world into a very dangerous position. And both countries need to avoid the hard conflict, and we have to stabilize the relation. Like Munich Security Conference said, it's become a lose-lose if we really cannot achieve a win-win. So I think, Minister Wang said absolutely correct, and the U.S. has to reflect that and I think modify that.
Yeah. Then I guess when he was responding to a question about China-EU ties, Wang Yi suggested that as long as China and Europe have mutually beneficial cooperation, there will be no bloc confrontation. On the EU side, it has defined China as both a partner and then a strategic competitor. But of course, from China's perspective, such a mindset does not really work. Now, Nassim, it seems the EU side is somehow expecting China to persuade Russia to withdraw its troops from Ukraine, for example. From China's perspective, that's probably unrealistic expectation. And in this regard, China's foreign minister said that China always holds a just, fair position, and Beijing's goal is to stop the war. He said the sooner that the two parties can talk, the sooner peace will come. So what do you think is China's role in terms of seeking solutions to the crisis in Ukraine?
I think as far as I've been following this entire conflict, so when we say that EU is somehow expecting China to persuade Russia to withdraw its troops, my a question that comes to my mind is, did the EU consult China before this conflict was starting? So if not, then if the whole world is facing the impact and the challenges are expanding because of this conflict, now how do you expect, like so bluntly, that China should persuade Russia to withdraw its troops? Like I earlier said, Russia did not take the war anywhere. It was brought to their door. So if it was brought to their door, then there had to be a reaction, and the reaction came. We can disagree on how Russia did it. But the situation is now out of the hands of EU, or, for instance, NATO, if we talk of the conflict. Now, expecting all of a sudden that China should persuade Russia, I don't think so. It's that easy when it comes to the relationships between countries, especially with the greater powers like Russia and China, that China can just wake up one day and the foreign minister can visit Moscow and he can ask them to please withdraw the troops because the EU is asking for it. So this is not how foreign relations work, because, and then it shows the frustration. So either when you are going into this conflict, you should, either you did your calculations were entirely wrong. So if they were wrong, then you have to accept it, that this is where we went wrong. Then from there you can proceed with a very open heart, and if you actually want an end to that conflict. So you cannot just, someone, like for example, someone creates a mess and then the other one asks for someone else to clear it up for them. It is not how things are working. So when it comes to EU terming China as a partner and then a strategic rival or a strategic competitor, like you also mentioned, these things they cannot go hand in hand. Either you are a partner, or there might be strategic, benefits on both sides, but you cannot be a rival and a partner at the same time. Yeah. So either you have positive competition. On one hand, you want or you expect Chinese companies to invest in the region, or vice versa. And on the other hand, like Dr. Wang mentioned as well, you put sanctions on companies. So you do not, whenever it comes to your benefit, you want to take that opportunity. But if someone else is excelling or they take a lead in something from you, then you bring in sanctions. Or you bring in, let's say with the example of the vehicles which were being stopped at the ports in the U.S., and then you bring in that forced labor was used in building these cars or these things. This is, you cannot be politically correct as well as you, on the other hand, you are trying to acquire all the economic benefits as well. So things should be made clear, and the EU as a whole should understand, and as well as big countries in European Union should also realize. And I think there is a realization amongst some big countries within the European Union that things are not going as they expected it to be. So I this is my take on how the Wang Yi responded to this question. So, but these talks should proceed and they should be held quickly, because at the end of the day, it's the people of Ukraine who are suffering. That's the common people, and then the economy of the entire world is suffering because of these conflicts.
And of course, apart from Ukraine, another hotspot conflict is the ongoing war in Gaza, but that's another issue. That's another issue that Wang Yi has addressed as well, and he has also addressed some of the other issues like AI, international cooperation. But unfortunately, we don't have enough time to go over these issues one by one. But thank you very much. We have been speaking with Dr. Wang Huiyao and Nassim Khan Ajikaza.
I am Dan Wang, Chief Economist of Hang Seng Bank China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
You are listening to World Today. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. The leader of a listed cybersecurity company is urging China to explore the innovative application of AI plus security as the rapid development of artificial intelligence brings about both opportunities and risks. Chairman Qi Xiangdong of Qianxin Technology Group, who is also a national political advisor, has proposed that the government establish industry standards and supervise the application of AI through legislation. Qi also told our reporter Xu Yawen that AI provides an even greater opportunity for the growth of the cybersecurity industry. And before we are to air this particular interview, to inform our listeners, this is actually our first time trying to use AI technology for a voiceover.
One of your proposals during this year's two sessions is the innovative development of AI plus security. Could you elaborate more on that?
AI is the core of the new technology revolution, greatly enhancing productivity. So now we have a new wave of AI technology revolution. But AI also increases the risk of data breaches. This includes deepfake scams, fake videos, face swapping, and so on, bringing new challenges to cybersecurity. At the same time, AI technology is also used by cyber hackers, cyber attack organizations. It also led to a significant increase in both the quality and quantity of cyber attack incidents. That is to say, it has brought greater risks to all aspects to our cybersecurity. So my proposal this year is to develop AI plus security to safeguard China's modernization.
Based on your observation, what impacts and challenges does AI bring to China's cybersecurity? What's your take on the capability of Chinese enterprises and industries to cope with the potential risks brought by the rapid development of AI?
The risks that artificial intelligence poses to our national cybersecurity mainly revolve around the following aspects. Firstly, there is the issue of content forgery. As our society progresses towards a greater legal and credit-based society, trust forms the basis of interpersonal interactions. However, artificial intelligence can fabricate various things, such as fake videos, photos, and voices, making it difficult to distinguish between truth and falsehood. There's a common saying that seeing is believing, but now, even what our eyes see can be false. These challenge the mechanisms of social trust that we have already established, leading to crises in social trust. They have significant impacts on social security, political stability, government governance, and cybersecurity. Secondly, artificial intelligence helps individuals perform their tasks better, particularly assisting programmers in writing code. This capability could enable individuals who did not know about cyber attacks become hackers using artificial intelligence. An amateur hacker, with the assistance of AI, may evolve into an advanced hacker. Originally, hackers were just a small special group of individuals. With the proliferation of AI technology, the hacker community may expand rapidly, and their technical capabilities may improve significantly, posing huge threats to our cybersecurity. Thirdly, AI contributes to cyber attacks with substantial impacts and a noticeable trend towards the weaponization of AI. We understand that future warfare might replace traditional warfare with cyber warfare. Previously, it's quite challenging to wage a cyber war. With the widespread adoption of AI, if AI becomes weaponized, it could break the bottleneck of human talent. This could escalate the scale of cyber warfare, causing greater harm. So, while AI development does bring about positive benefits, enhancing our quality of life and accelerating economic and social development, It also presents adverse effects by rendering our networks insecure. The insecurity of our networks threatens the security of our traditional society.
While developing technology, how should the Chinese government participate in the governance and regulation of AI? And from which aspects should we start planning to address these potential risks?
I believe that the first thing to do is to enact laws. Since artificial intelligence has so many negative aspects, especially its use in forgery, it is challenging for ordinary people to discern. This put ordinary people at a great disadvantage. Therefore, we need laws to regulate the development of AI if the society wants to develop in an orderly manner. Currently, legislation regarding AI, including in China, has prompted legislative bodies worldwide into action. Scientists and experts in the field of artificial intelligence have been urging governments to expedite the enactment of legislation to regulate the development path and direction of AI, which mitigates the harm posed to society by data breaches, cyber attacks, and even bioethical violations. Secondly, it is to establish standards. AI is transforming our lives and creating value for various industries. This integration reduces the cost of application and provides equal opportunities for businesses, governments, and industries to utilize AI. Establishing standards ensures that different countries at different stages of development, as well as individuals of varying ages and educational backgrounds, can enjoy the benefits brought by AI more equally. The third aspect involves promoting collaborative innovation. AI development relies on core technologies, prompting countries, including China, to enact a series of policies to seize the initiative in AI innovation. Breakthroughs in AI technology, including AI chips, algorithm structures, and the open exchange of AI-related data are essential. However, for AI technology to truly flourish, it must integrate with different industries and create a better life for everyone. Such integration requires collaborative innovation, so it is essential to mobilize various enterprises, especially leading ones, to embrace the future and form innovative alliances with professional AI companies.
So given the rapid development of AI and the growing demand for cybersecurity and data security in China, what opportunities do you think this trend will bring to companies like Qianxin and the entire industry?
I believe this will bring enormous development opportunities to the cybersecurity industry. We understand that cybersecurity is a semi-finished technology, providing customers with scenario-based protection solutions. Without revolutionary changes in technology, the development of cybersecurity industry would be lukewarm. Additionally, without the emerging new digital scenarios, the cybersecurity industry's technological innovation would lose direction and momentum. We are now entering a digital age where our traditional economy is undergoing comprehensive transformation into a digital one. This transition inherently presents great business opportunities and development prospects for the cybersecurity industry. Without cybersecurity, there is no national security, no production security, and no financial security. In recent years, the global cybersecurity industry, including China's, has experienced explosive growth. Moreover, the development of artificial intelligence provides an even greater opportunity for the growth of the cybersecurity industry.
Qi Xiangdong, a national political advisor as well as chairperson of Qianxin Technology Group, talking to my colleague Xu Yawen. You are listening to World Today. We'll be back. You're listening to World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. In the United States, Nikki Haley has put an end to her campaign for the U.S. president. Haley announced her decision in a speech in her home state of South Carolina on Wednesday, a day after Donald Trump, the former president, defeated her in all but one of the Republican primary contests held on Super Tuesday. However, the former American ambassador to the UN has not endorsed Donald Trump, saying the former president still needs to win over her supporters. So joining us now on the line is Dr. Edward Lehman, Managing Director of Lehman Lee and Xu Law Firm. So thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Lehman. Actually, throughout her campaign, Nikki Haley had cast herself as a voice for traditional, you know, conservative ideas regarding economic or foreign policy, and really part of a new generation of political leadership for the United States. So with that in mind, does it come as a surprise to you that she has not endorsed Trump?
Well, I think, you know, it's been a long time in coming. She's been running for 13 months. It's been largely, you know, a very difficult battle for her, of course. I mean, she lost 14 out of the 15 events. I mean, she's built up a war chest starting in 2019 when she established a not-for-profit called Stand for America, which they had put together $71 million and with, you know, billionaire donors, Paul Singer, Stanley Druckenmiller, Sheldon and Miriam Adelson, and Scott Bessent. So there's a lot that has been, you know, put into her campaign. I mean, she's a remarkable woman, certainly. She's 52 years old, still very young, and, I mean, by political standards compared to Mr. Trump. I don't see it as a surprise that she's not yet endorsed Trump. She may come around to endorsing Trump. He's inevitably going to be the candidate, of course. I mean, he's the last person standing. Her concession speech was only 519 words, lasted about 4 minutes and 5 seconds. And she was very mindful about saying that she is a conservative. And exactly like you said, and then the only question is, would she, you know, go into supporting Mr. Biden? And most likely not, because, I mean, if she says she's a conservative, I mean, yeah. Mr. Biden is a lot of things, but not that.
Okay, we will talk about that in more details later on in our discussion. But before that, we understand her coalition of supporters includes Trump-resistant Republicans as well as some independents. These are people that are relatively higher educated, more moderate, suburban people, etc., etc. So I guess these people, on one hand, have been proved to be too small in terms of stopping Mr. Trump's march to the Republican nomination. But on the other hand, Dr. Lehman, how would you evaluate the power of these people in terms of deciding the outcome of a rematch between Biden and Trump?
Yeah, I mean, that remains to be seen, of course. The numbers are not insignificant. I mean, she did win Vermont. She did win the District of Columbia. And where she did lose in places like New Hampshire, I mean, she got 40% of the vote. So that's not nothing, certainly. And then, like you had said, that there's these never Trumpers that are never going to want to be a part of him or his organization. But then they've got to select the lesser of two evils. Unless there's going to be a credible third party candidate, and Nikki Haley said that she wasn't going to be a third party candidate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, most likely would be the recipient of this group if he were to run in a third party candidacy. But that doesn't really seem like it's been materializing at all. So the question is whether, you know, Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump are almost at polar opposites with regards to what they stand for. And Mr. Biden hasn't helped out his cause much because of, you know, his public appearances haven't been as fluid as they probably could be. And so it would be very difficult probably to flip some of these never Trumpers to go all the way over on to a different side. Now, if Mr. Biden, which he's trying to do, is move more towards the middle, but it's very difficult to do this at this kind of late stage after he's had a number of years being president, in order to dress himself up as a moderate. But he's really appearing to have been swayed by the very far left side of his party. And so the never Trumpers, you know, are stuck with a, you know, a kind of an unbelievable choice about not voting you know, or voting for Mr. Biden or not voting for by or voting for Mr. Trump, where they at least have some kind of conservative values. It might not be consistent with the kind of personality that they would like in the office, but it's at least more conservative than Mr. Biden.
Mm. So in a statement released on Wednesday, Mr. Biden made a direct appeal to Haley voters, actually saying, quote unquote, there is a place for them in his campaign. He talked about some of the possible common grounds like preserving America's democracy and standing up for the rule of law or treating each other with respect and decency. So do you think those issues that Biden has talked about will enable him to win over Haley supporters?
You know, I think it was very good politics that he decided to reach out across the aisle and make an appeal, a direct appeal to the Haley voters. I think obviously he's going to be the recipient of some of those voters. Whether he's going to receive all of them is another question. I mean, some of the responses that were in places like South Carolina is, yeah, I'm going to be voting for Nikki Haley, but you know, if Nikki Haley doesn't win, I'm going to, you know, support Mr. Trump. I mean, that's not a scientific poll by any stretch, and that was some feedback that I had seen. But Mr. Biden is an astute politician, if he's nothing else. I mean, he's been around as a politician for 50 some years almost, and so I think it's a good thing he's done it. I think he will win some supporters, but the question is, will that be enough to bring him? Now, remember, Mr. Biden has been voted for by more persons than any other presidential race. So, I mean, he's selected and elected last time with the largest number of plurality. And so he's not without his surprises. And there could be farther things, that are believable, more unbelievable than them crossing the aisle and voting for Mr. Biden.
Mm. So according to a February poll, actually almost 1 in 5 American voters are considered to be double haters, namely people who are unhappy with both Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden. So do you think this kind of empathy will stop many of these voters from casting a ballot at all? And if that would be the case, how do you think a scenario like that might have an impact on the final result of a Biden-Trump rematch?
Yeah, I mean, good question. I think, I mean, the double haters, they're there, the never Bidens, the never Trumpers. And, you know, the question is whether they'll actually just cross each other out. Some of the things that were notable about the Super Tuesday election in the Democratic side for president were, some states had voted, I think it was Colorado, that there was about 18% that actually, you know, selected, you know, said they weren't going to be behind President Biden. That's highly unusual, frankly. And I, you know, there's not been sort of a lackluster response for an incumbent since Jimmy Carter in 1980. So I don't know if that's indicative or whether people, you know, what happened last time was a surprise, I think, to many people. Mr. Trump was an incumbent. Mr. Biden was the challenger. And, it was a not predicted kind of a situation. And the same thing could happen in this. But like I said, both of them might, the double haters might both stay home from the polling booth at that time. It would just cross each other out. If a third party candidate came into play, I think that would change a lot of momentum for one side or the other. And, you know, all we can do is let the people speak when they do vote. And it's going to be a very interesting and challenging election, I think, for both sides. But don't count Mr. Biden out. I know he doesn't seem to be doing well in the polls and as far as a popularity is concerned. But it's hard to call it at this point in time with who can win. It's a long ways away. It's 8 months away to the general election.
Okay, thank you. That was Dr. Edward Lehman, Managing Director of Lehman Lee and Shi Law Firm. Thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to World Today. We'll be back. You are listening to World Today. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. Egypt has secured a deal to more than double its IMF bailout to $8 billion after devaluing its currency by 40%. The country's central bank has also massively raised the interest rates to relieve a foreign currency shortage. Allowing market forces to set the value for the country's currency was a key condition for the country to access more funds from the International Monetary Fund as part of a $3 billion bailout deal in 2022. Egypt is facing some mounting economic and social pressures that have been somehow further exacerbated by the war in Gaza, as well as the disruption ongoing in the Red Sea. So joining us now on the line is Dr. Qu Qiang, a research fellow from Beijing Foreign Studies University. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So actually, Egypt recorded an inflation rate of nearly 30% back in January this year. So I guess allowing its own currency to devalue by such a significant degree would certainly pile some additional hardships towards average families, average households in this country. So why do you think Egyptian authorities have made this very decision anyway?
Well, this is really a very difficult situation for Egypt government. So they have to make a choice. At least they have to make a choice between the worst thing and the worst thing, the worst thing. So I think they try to, just try to minimize what the loss in their national economy. So recently, their inflation ratio is nearly about 30%. And also, they're facing a very, very bad foreign debt situation, as well as the government and the national income due to the current geopolitical conflicts and et cetera. So I think they have the choice is that either they keep the situation this way and people will build a very negative expectation over the Egypt future and their economy. So this kind of a bad expectation will always drive forward what we call the animal spirit. So people will fear, and a fear will cause, further dump on the Egypt pound and Egypt, stock market and Egypt bond. So the things will get worse. Instead of facing that kind of situation, so Egypt, monetary authority just to raise up their interest rate. And while the people will see, okay, government trying to, to tighten up their monetary supply, they don't want to let the inflation and debt issue to get that worse. The government is ready to pay up for that kind of situation. So the expectation at least will be stabilized. Okay. And the capital flight out of Egypt will slow down a little bit so they can make the situation a little bit better. And also the Egypt government mentioned, foreign exchange ratio will be more in line with the market ratio. So they're telling people, okay, we're not going to intervene. So you're still going to have the liberty to, trade between different currencies in Egypt market as many as you want. So what they do that is just trying to use the market to rebalance the whole monetary and capital market. It's also aimed to, stabilize expectation of the domestic and foreign market. So that just trying to stop the things getting worse. Well, can they make the things better and, rebound the Egypt economy? We still need time to see. But I think until we can see the fundamentals in Egypt economy and also the geopolitical conflicts can be, eased into some more peaceful situation, I don't think Egypt can face some fundamental change and rally in their economy and financial status.
Okay, your point's well taken. So an Abu Dhabi-based investment vehicle named ADQ has recently decided to inject $35 billion into Egypt, which according to some media reports is actually the biggest single investment in the country's history. Now, the cash and the money involved here has reportedly provided the Egyptian's central bank with a kind of buffer to prevent its local currency, its own currency, from a free fall once the controls are lifted. So why do you think the UAE or the Gulf countries in general have an interest in terms of providing Egypt with what is essentially, I guess, a bailout?
Well, first of all, I think UAE and Qatar, as well as Saudi Arabia, they played a very important role as the economic leader in this region. And also, they're the economic leaders in the Arabic and the Islamic world. So they always try to shoulder this responsibility for the regional stability and the peace, because eventually the peace environment of this whole region fits their own benefit. For example, you see the Red Sea crisis are happening. This crisis is not only, harming the economy of Egypt, which is like the Suez Canal is basically providing $8 billion annual income to Egypt, but also the whole environment can affect the area, like Saudi Arabia's import and the UAE's import and export. So these countries, they really want to stabilize the situation so they can also benefit from it or reduce the loss from it. So that's a reason why in all these years, they try to help with Iraq, with Yemen, with the situation in Palestine, as well as in Egypt. It's fitting their own benefit. And the second thing is that Egypt itself is a very important Arabic country member. It has more than 100 million population. Yeah. It's probably the most important center for the Arabic modern culture. So everybody would like to, in this whole world, would like to have their own influence in Egypt, as well as Egypt has a very important geopolitical position importance. For example, its coastline border has been adjacent to the Red Sea, to the Palestine area, as well as to the Mediterranean. So this country trying to help them out is also trying to help themselves to have a bigger role and a position in this regional influences.
Okay. Now, it seems this ongoing crisis in the Gaza Strip, as well as the ongoing disruption ongoing over there in the Red Sea, are only immediate factor for Egypt's current economic hardship, because since the year 2016, Egypt has been forced to go to the IMF for multiple loans, and it is currently the fund's second largest debtor after a Latin American country, Argentina. So what do you think are the long-term structural challenges faced by the country? 1 minute.
Okay, well, for short, they have to take it because it's a very tough pill to swallow, but they need this pill for a very urgent medical situation financially. But in the long run, they have to apply for the austerity policy in their fiscal situation and policy, as well as they will provide an even harder life standard or hard life situation for the normal people, because the whole country need to pay off this long-term debt.
Thank you for joining us as always. That was Dr. Qu Qiang, Research Fellow of Global Issues from Beijing Foreign Studies University. Unfortunately, that's all the time for this edition of World Today. A quick recap of today's headline news. China's foreign ministry vows that China will always be a force for peace and stability. Nikki Haley ends her presidential bid, but does now endorse former US President Donald Trump. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on our previous episodes, download our podcast by searching World Today. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. Thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.